Kip had ever seen. They were eyes to make satraps squirm and queens faint. The eyes of Orhulam's chosen. Kip's eyes were plain blue, which did nothing for him except mark him as a crossbreed. Maybe some blood forester lineage. Like most peoples, Tyrians had dark eyes. Kip's hair was dark as a Tyrian's, but tightly curled like a Parian's or an Elysian's, rather than straight or wavy. Enough to mark him a freak. But nowhere near enough to mark him this man's son. Of course, his mother hadn't had the look of a Tyrian either, which just complicated things. Darker than either, with kinky hair and hazel eyes, Kip tried to imagine what the child of his mother and this man might look like, but he couldn't do it. Blend enough mutts and who knows what you'll get. Maybe if he weren't so fat, he might see it. Maybe it was simply a cruel trick. A lie. The prism. The prism himself? How could such a man be Kip's father? He'd said he hadn't known Kip even existed. How could that happen? The answer seemed pretty obvious. It had been during the war. Gavin's army had met Dazin's not far from Recton. So as they'd come through town, Gavin had met Lena. He was the prism, heading to what might be his death. She was a young, pretty girl whose town had been destroyed. She'd shared his bed. Then he'd gone on to kill his brother. Perhaps the very next day. And in the aftermath of the war, and the reconstruction, and the work of putting down the rest of the rebellion, and rebuilding alliances, and administering the peace, he'd probably never thought of her again. Even if he had, Tyria wasn't exactly the friendliest or safest of places for the prism back then. It had sided with Dazin, the evil brother, and been treated cruelly as a result. Or maybe Gavin had raped Lena. But that didn't make sense. Why would a rapist claim Kip? Especially because it obviously cost Gavin a lot to do so. Kip could imagine his mother, pregnant, unmarried, left in the devastation that was Recton. Of course she'd want to escape. Kip would have been her one hope. What would she have done? Travel alone to Garriston, where the victors were administering Tyria? He could imagine that well enough. His mother presenting herself to some governor demanding to see Gavin Guile because she bore his bastard. She'd have been lucky if she got as far as a governor with that tale. So she'd been turned away, her dreams of anything good or easy in her life dashed. Whenever she looked at Kip, she didn't see her own bad choices. She saw Gavin's betrayal and her disappointment. Kip was a dream dashed. Within half an hour, Kip was tiring. His arms were burning. He thought of how Gavin had practically sprinted for hours. The thought of waking the prism so soon shamed him. He'd always tired quickly, but if he pushed through his initial fatigue, he had a lot of stamina. He wasn't going to wake the prism. Not at all. Let the man rest. He'd earned that much from Kip. Kip would keep going until Gavin woke, even if it killed him. He swore it. The oath made Kip feel good. He was insignificant and nothing. But he could give the prism himself a good night's sleep. He could do something. He could matter in a small way, but a bigger way than he ever had in his whole life. He kept going. The prism had saved him today. The prism himself. Gavin had faced down King Charadul. He'd killed a score or more of Charadul's mirrormen and walked away. And Kip had probably endangered it all by trying to attack the king. How stupid could he get? With all the drafters there, Kip had thought he could get to the king. Stupid. Despite the coolness of the night, it wasn't long before Kip was covered in sweat. His fast walk had become a trudge, but that trudge still drove the skull as fast as a horse's canter. Kip was so focused on just keeping going that he was on top of the camp before he noticed it. There were maybe a dozen men carousing around a fire, drinking and laughing as one strummed a badly out-of-tune lute. Kip kept trudging, his brain slow to take in what this had to be. The men were all armed, including one who looked like he was supposed to be on watch. That one still held his crossbow cocked and ready against his shoulder. Kip thought of whispering to wake Gavin, but they were so close that anything loud enough to wake the prism might be loud enough to carry over the water to the crossbow man, who stood just at the edge of the firelight. His body turned toward the river, but his head turned to his comrades. The skull made only a slight hiss as it cut across the water. Surely it would be inaudible beneath the merry crackling of the bandits' fire. The bandits had partially dammed the river, with rocks pinching in from either side. They'd laid wood planks over the top to make a walkway with only a tiny gap in the middle. Any boat that tried to get through would be within range of at least their spears. Kip could disengage himself from the oars and touch Gavin, but what could Gavin do? It was night. There wasn't much light for a prison to work with. Maybe if Kip had woken him earlier. Now it was too late. He'd probably killed them. He'd have to shoot for the gap and hope for the best. He aimed the skull at the gap and gasped, as at the last second the moonlight cut through the water and revealed the bandit's last trap. A stout, sharpened pole was embedded in the riverbed and stuck up to within a few thumbs of the surface of the water. Anyone who tried to shoot the gap would find themselves hung up with a gaping hole in their hull. The skull's Luxin hull barely brushed the pole and slid past. Kip shot a glance at the crossbowman as the skull slipped through the teeth of the bandit's trap. The man was only a few years older than Kip. He was laughing, happy, hand extended to one of the other men, asking for a skin of wine. Then Kip was through. The crossbowman turned, shaking his head, then froze as he saw Kip. In the dark, the translucent Luxin must have been well-nigh invisible to the sentry's fire-spoiled night vision. He was seeing a fat boy running past him, on the river's surface. Impossible. Kip smiled and waved. The sentry lifted a hand and waved back. Froze. Looked back at his comrades, at the fire. His mouth opened to shout an alarm, but nothing came out. He turned back to the river and looked for Kip. Kip was still within easy crossbow shot. He knew that, but he didn't speed up, even though, at this moment, he had energy to spare. Anything he did might spook the sentry. The sentry stared hard into the darkness at the disappearing ghost and said nothing. He rubbed his forehead in consternation, shook his head, and turned back to his friends. Then Kip ran, not for long, but after a minute of running, the skull was hundreds of paces downriver. Kip returned to his walk. He smiled. Stupid as it had been, he'd made it through without even waking the prison. He didn't know how long he walked. He tried to keep an eye on the shore, but weariness had sunk into his bones. He passed smaller camps, whether of bandits or just innocent travellers, he couldn't tell, but each time he saw them he slowed to a crawl until he could see that all the men in the camp were asleep. He even did his trick again of unfocusing his eyes, and he could see the sleeping lumps of several more men than his focused eyes could, but never another sentry. The sky didn't lighten for what seemed a thousand years. Kip's legs were burning, his lungs ached, he could barely feel his arms, but he refused to stop. Even at his bare trudge, the skull still moved twice as fast as a punt. Finally, the sun touched the mountains. As always, daylight came long before the sun could climb the Kasos Mountains' backs to announce sunrise. And still the prism didn't wake. Kip wouldn't stop walking, not now. He'd gone all night. Surely the prism would wake any moment and see what Kip had done. He would be impressed. He would look at Kip with new eyes. Kip would be more than a burden, a shame, a bastard to be quietly admitted and then avoided. The prism stirred, and Kip's heart leapt. But then the man settled back in, his breathing steady once more. Kip despaired. He looked to the rising sun. Was he going to have to wait until the light shone directly on the prism's face? That would be another hour at least. Kip swallowed. His tongue felt thick and dry, raspy as a file. How long had it been since he'd had a drink? A river beneath his feet, and he was parched. He needed a drink. He was past needing a drink. If he didn't drink, he was going to pass out. The prison's wineskin wasn't even a full pace away. Kip stopped walking. His legs quivered. His feet were numb, and now they hurt as the blood leached back into them. He extricated himself from the oar mechanism and stepped over to grab the wineskin. Or tried to. His numb feet got tangled up, and he pitched forward, barely able to twist one way so he didn't crush the prism. His turned shoulder slammed onto the skull's gunwale, and suddenly everything that had been good about the skull turned bad. The shallow displacement that had allowed the boat to slip over the bandit's trap meant no stability. The bowl-like flare of the slick hull that had allowed them to slide over rocks meant that the sudden shift in weight was cataclysmic. One moment, Kip was staring at the river from thumbs away. The next, The entire scowl flipped. Kip's head went in first, and yet, despite the water closing over his ears and the thrashing of his own stupid, clumsy limbs and the crashing of the rest of the skull hitting the water, somehow he was certain he heard a man's startled yell. The river was warm. Kip was so mortified, he decided to just die and get it over with. He'd just dunked the prism into the river. Or Hollum. Oh, he'll be real impressed now, Kip. Then his lungs started burning, and the idea of quietly dying to remove one ignominious blot from creation lost all appeal. Kip thrashed, weakly. His legs decided now would be a good time to cramp. And both did. Then his left arm. He flapped in the water like a lame bird, got one gulp of air and plunged back down. Part of him knew he could float. He'd floated leagues down the river just yesterday, for panic had him fully in its grip. He floundered, took a breath at the wrong time, and sucked in water. His head hurt. Orholam, it was like someone was ripping out all of his hair. He spit and spluttered. He was in air. Sweet, precious air. Someone had grabbed him by the hair and pulled him out of the water. He coughed twice more and finally opened his eyes. The prism was winking at him. No, not winking. The prism was blinking away the water that Kip had just spat up into his face. Let me die now. The man hauled Kip into the scowl, now wider, with a keel, and much more stable than before. Kip hung his head and rubbed his arm and legs until they could move again. The prism was standing over him, waiting. Kip swallowed, wincing, and braced himself to meet the great man's fury. He looked up sheepishly. Love a morning swim, Gavin said. Quite bracing. And he winked. Chapter 22 Dazen Guile woke slowly, senses bombarded with the stultifying blue blandness of his dungeon. Three thunks, three hisses, and his breakfast fell onto the dungeon floor. Ignoring the cold in his limbs, ignoring the stiffness and pain in his body from sleeping on blue Luxon with only a thin blanket, he sat and folded his arms. The dead man was whistling tunelessly, sitting against the opposite wall, bobbing his head to a non-existent beat. The madness of blue was a madness of order. A Geist would understand every nuance of Gavin's prison, but every time Dazen sank into the madness, he was frightened that he'd never come out of it. The last time he'd tried must have been years ago. He'd drafted a lot of blue since then. Choosing a descent into the blue again might well be choosing annihilation. Dazen, the dead man said. You are Dazen this morning, aren't you? It was a favorite trick of the dead man's, pretending Dazen was the crazy one. You aren't thinking of going Geist, are you? He hated his brother for doing this, for forcing this choice. But there was no passion to his hatred. It was a bare fact, as naked as his own limbs, stripped of mystery. Enough. Better oblivion chosen of his own will than torture forever, according to his brothers. Dazen drafted blue like he was taking a deep breath. His fingernails turned, that hateful blue, his hands, arms. It spread over his chest like an icy cancer, and it cooled him. His hatred itself became an oddity, a mystery, something so irrational and powerful it couldn't be quantified or understood, merely accounted for approximately. The blue suffused his entire body. Bad idea, the dead man said. I don't think you'll come out of it this time. He started juggling little blue Luxin globes. He could handle five now. When Dazen had first met him, the dead man couldn't even juggle three. Without passion clouding his study, he could appreciate the cell. His brother was brilliant. What had he said after imprisoning him? I made this dungeon in a month. And you will have as long to break out as it takes. Consider it a test. Every time he had given up, he'd returned to that statement. It was an admission of imperfection. The cell could be broken. There was a weakness. He merely had to find it. Burhelstone isn't the weakness, the dead man said. Didn't I tell you? He respects you too much. It won't go a few thumbs deep. It'll go two paces. He was aware, briefly, of a human emotion barely at the threshold of his perception. loss. Fury at how he'd scrubbed piss and oil for years, years of degradation for nothing. His brother had no interest in degrading him. That wasn't his way. All that effort for nothing. He turned those feelings over like an odd stone in his hands, then tossed them aside. They only clouded his vision. Something was sitting right in front of his face, and he wasn't seeing it. There had to be something obvious, something that simply required him to look at the problem from a new angle. His brother had been so good at that kind of thinking. Maybe the only question is, are you going to do this Gavin's way, or Dazen's? The dead man asked. He had that little superior mocking smile. Dazen wanted to smash his face in when he grinned like that. But maybe he was right. That was the trap, trying to do this Gavin's way. If he did this his brother's way, it would only lead deeper. He put his Luxin-filled hands to the ground, feeling the outline of the whole structure. The cell was sealed, of course, hardened and guarded against simple magical tampering, but as before, it felt different to the south. Not that he was sure it was the south side, he'd merely decided that the one area that felt different would be the south for him, his lodestone. That was where his brother stood when he came to see him. It hadn't happened in a long time, but there was a room beyond the blue Luxin walls there, where Gavin could come when he wanted to check on his brother, to assure himself that he was still a prisoner, still safely kept from the world, still suffering as much as he hoped. That would be the weakness. The Luxin there had to be thinner, simpler, so Gavin could manipulate it so that he could see through it. It would be warded, of course, but Gavin couldn't have thought of everything. He'd only had a month. But Dazen's every attempt with fire had been a failure. Red Luxin was flammable, so he thought that if he cut himself, he could draft Red Luxin. He could, a little, but that was good for nothing unless he could make it burn. A fire would give him full-spectrum light to work with, and he would be able to get out, but he had nothing to make a spark. Trying to leech heat from his own body had nearly worked, or at least he'd thought he was close, and he'd nearly killed himself the last time by cooling his body too much. It just wasn't possible. He was going to die down here. There was nothing he could do. He drafted a sledgehammer and, screaming, smashed it against the wall. It shattered, of course. It didn't leave so much as a scratch. Dazen rubbed his face. No, the enemy was despair. He had to conserve his strength. Tomorrow he'd rub the bowl more. Maybe tomorrow would be the day. He knew it wouldn't, but he held on to the lie anyway. In the wall, the dead man was cackling. Chapter 23
"We need to talk about your future," Gavin said. "You have some choices."
Kip looked at the prism across their fire. Night was coming on fast in their little island. Kip had slept for hours, apparently, completely missing Garriston, and only waking as their boat lurched, hitting the sand as night fell.
"How long will I live?" Kip asked.
He was grumpy, hungry, and just starting to comprehend some of the implications of what had happened in the last 2 days.
"A question for O'Hollam himself. I'm just his humble prism," Gavin said, a wry smile twisting his lips. He was looking out into the darkness.
"You know what I mean."
It came out sharper than Kip meant. Everyone he knew was dead, and he was going to be a green drafter. He'd seen his future in the color white, death, or madness, and then death. Gavin's eyes snapped back to Kip. He moved to speak, stopped, then said, "When you draft, it changes your body, and your body interprets that change as damage. It heals what it can, but it's always a losing battle, like aging. Most male drafters make it to 40. Women average 50.
Then the Chromeria kills us, or we go mad?"
Gavin's face went hard.
"You're getting emotional. I don't think you're ready for this."
"Not ready," Kip said.
Gavin was right. Kip knew it. He was on edge. He should just shut up. But he couldn't help himself.
"I wasn't ready for everyone I know to be murdered. I wasn't ready to impale some horsemen and jump over a waterfall. Words are nothing. What is it? Once we aren't useful anymore, we have to kill ourselves." Why was he yelling? Why was he trembling? Or Holm, he'd sworn on his soul to kill a king. Was he mad already?
Something like that.
That will turn into a colour white?
Kip asked.
That's right. Well, I guess we've talked about my future, Kip said bitterly.
He knew he was being snotty, but he couldn't stop himself.
That wasn't what I meant, and you know it, Gavin said.
How would you know what I know, father?
It was like watching a spring release. One second the prison was sitting across the fire from Kip, the next he stood right in front of Kip, his arm drawn back. The next, Kip was hitting the sand, head ringing from Gavin's open-handed blow, arse scraped from sliding off his log, his wind taken by the fall.
You've been through hell, so I've given you more slack than I give any man. You wanted to find the line? You've found it.
Kip rolled face up as he caught his breath. He had sand sticking to the wetness at the corner of his mouth. He rubbed it.
Just slobber, not blood.
Or Holm's balls, he said. Guess what I've found? A line. I'm the greatest discoverer since Aris the Navigator.
Gavin trembled, his face a mask. He rolled his shoulders, popped his neck, right and left. Though his back was to their fire, Kip could see red Luxin smoke swirls curling into his eyes.
What are you going to do? Beat me? Kip demanded.
It's just pain. Sometimes Kip hated himself for how he saw weakness. The prism threatened him, and the first thing Kip saw was the threat's emptiness. Gavin couldn't beat him precisely because Gavin was a good man, and Kip was defenseless. Gavin's look darkened to murder for one moment, then cleared to simple intensity, the briefest flicker of amusement. Take a deep breath, he said quietly.
What?
The prism made a little backhanded gesture as if whisking away a fly. A gob of red Luxin flicked out of his hand and splattered over Kip's mouth. Kip took a deep breath through his nose before the Luxin spread and covered that, too. Then it wrapped around the back of his head, spread over the top of his head, and solidified. Only Kip's eyes were uncovered. Mouth and nose were covered, utterly blocked. He couldn't breathe. Gavin said, "You remind me of my brother. I could never win against him growing up. And when I did, he'd give me some patronizing praise that made me wonder if he'd let me win. You see the cracks in things? Fine. It's proof enough that you're a guile. A whole family has it, including me. Think about this, Kip. There are a lot of problems that will go away for me if I leave that mask on your face until you're dead. You might want to think twice before you try to use a man's conscience against him. It may turn out he doesn't have one." Kip listened, conserving his strength against his rising panic, certain that after Gavin was done talking, he would take the Luxin off his face. But Gavin stopped talking, and he didn't remove the mask. Kip's stomach churned as his diaphragm worked to suck in more air, pumped down to expel the dead air he held in. Nothing. He reached up to his neck, trying to find the seam where Luxin abutted skin, but the line was smooth, the Luxin sticking close to the skin. He couldn't get his fingernails under it. He reached up around his head, his eyes. If he stabbed his fingernails into the soft skin next to his eyes, he could lift the edge of the mask and get one finger underneath it. His vision was darkening. He looked at Gavin, pleading, sure that the man would step in now. Gavin watched him, pitiless.
If the only thing you're going to respect is strength, Kip, first, you're a fool, and second, you've come to the right man.
The panic came. He should have known better. Kip thrashed, tried to scream, reached up to that thin ridge of Luxin by his eyes, but he barely touched it before his hands drooped. He should have known. He couldn't trust.
Chapter 24. After travelling all day and into the night, Caris first became aware of Recton in the distance as a great, unvariegated glow as she stalked through the forest. It was long after nightfall now, the air cool in the undergrowth. She was enough of a sub-red to use dark vision, but it wasn't perfect, and on a moonlit night like tonight she kept switching back and forth from normal to dark vision. Light below the visible spectrum was rougher. It didn't lend itself to fine differentiation of features.
Even faces simply looked like warm blobs, brighter here and there. But it was much more difficult to make out expressions or fine movements, or even to identify a face from much of a distance. The glow meant Recton was still burning. Caris circled it slowly, climbing the last hill. She stayed off the road, admiring the waterfall just below the town in the silver moonlight. She hadn't seen anyone on the road all day, which she found odd. If no one was fleeing downriver from Recton, it probably meant no one had made it out. But it was also strange to follow the river through arable land and not come across any other settlements. She'd seen orange orchards that clearly hadn't been tended since the war, but they were still growing fruit. The fruit was sparse and the trees leafy and chaotic and growing haphazardly in comparison to the paintings Caris had seen of orange harvests, but they were still here. With the price Tyrian oranges fetched, she found that hard to believe. Tyrian oranges were smaller, but sweeter and juicier than Natashian oranges, and the Parian oranges didn't even compare. No one had moved back after the war? Had the Battle of Sundered Rock really killed so many that even now, 16 years later, the land lay fallow, bearing fruit for deer and bears alone? Caris didn't see any bodies until she crept into the still-burning town, wrapped in her hooded black cloak. She was following the main road, its cobbles even and well-maintained, a symbol in Caris's mind of a place well-governed. A burned body lay in the middle of the street, face down, one arm extended, a finger pointing deeper into the town. Only the hand and pointing finger were unburned. The head was missing. She hadn't seen this kind of burn since the war. During the war, the armies had clashed a number of times in areas where the bodies couldn't be buried, and where there wasn't enough natural fuel for funeral pyres. Corpses had to be disposed of to avoid losing even more soldiers to disease, so red drafters would spray a corpse with a quick stream of red jelly. A quick coating, even if drafted carelessly, could be lit quickly. Problem solved. It wasn't cremation, though. If bodies were burned singly rather than in piles, the bones remained. If the drafter weren't thorough, certain body parts wouldn't be reduced entirely to bone. Rib cages and skulls ended up full of smoking meat. Good enough for exigencies of war when you had to dispose of your opponent's corpses to avoid spreading disease, but never good enough for one's own countrymen. King Haradul hadn't fought in that war, but he was aping the worst practices of it. On his own people. As she suspected, that pointing hand led Caris to more bodies. At first they were spread widely, then one every 30 paces, one every 20 paces, one every 10. All were headless. Then bodies lined the sides of the main road now in a solid row, past smoking, crumbled homes and shops. The nicely maintained cobblestones here had cracked from the heat. There were tracks across the cobbles. At first she couldn't tell what they were, but as she got closer it became obvious. There were drag marks, streaks of dried blood, perhaps a day old, from the decapitated bodies being dragged from the square. She paused amid the smoke and gore before she rounded the corner that would take her to the town square. She drew the short sword but didn't put on her spectacles. If there was a trap, it would be here. But there was enough red and heat for her to fight magically if necessary. Even if she wasn't planning on a straight infiltration, there was no need to announce that she was a drafter if she didn't have to. When the moment came, she'd announce it with fire. Caris rounded the corner. Deer or Hollum. They hadn't melted the heads. They'd preserved them with a blue and yellow Luxin glaze and stacked them in the middle of the town square, eyes staring, faces mangled, blood cascading from the top to the bottom like a champagne pyramid at the Lux Lord's ball. Caris had half expected something like this from all the decapitated bodies, but expecting it wasn't the same as seeing it. Her stomach heaved. She turned and clamped her jaw shut, blinking rapidly, as if her eyelids could scrape the horrors off her eyes. She studied the rest of the square to give her stomach time to settle. If Gavin had seen this, he would have killed King Haradul. Pitiless as the sea, righteous as Orholm, he would have hunted down every one of these monsters. Whatever he had done during the war and before, whatever he had done to her since the False Prism's war, Gavin had travelled the 7 satrapies meeting out justice. He'd sunk Elysian pirate fleets twice. killed the bandit king of the blue-eyed demons, made peace when war had broken out again between Hrothgar and the Blood Forest, and brought the Butcher of Rue to justice. Other than the Tyrians, the people loved him. And he would have wreaked a mighty vengeance here, even for Tyrians. He wouldn't have stood for this. Most of the buildings were piles of rubble, smoking in the pre-dawn grey. Here and there a single wall stood, scorched and blackened and separated from its fallen fellows. The Alcaldessa's residence, if such it was the grandest building she'd seen here, with steps leading directly onto the square, was a total loss. The soldiers had flattened it. There wasn't one rock left sitting on another. But the square itself was immaculate. Any burnt wreckage had either been pushed into the streets leading here, or shoveled directly into the river, whose channel bounded the square to the west. King Haradul had wanted nothing to distract a visitor from his grisly trophy. Steeling herself, Caris looked back to the pyramid of human heads. All the drag marks, all the bloody streaks led here. The bodies, Caris hoped they'd all already been bodies by the time they came here, had all been decapitated here so that the pyramid would be as bloody as possible. This was a spectacle. King Haradul wanted everything to lead to this horror. The pyramid was taller than Caris. The heads at the top, crowning the pyramid, were children, round-cheeked little boys and little girls with their hair in ribbons and bows. Caris didn't throw up. There was something about this that simply left her cold. By their ages and her own, those children could have been hers. She found herself counting the heads. There were 45 at the base, and the pyramid was as wide as it was tall, built with mathematical precision. The children's heads were smaller, and there was no way to tell if the pyramid was solid, or if these heads had been stacked around the outside of a smaller pyramid made of something else. Caris's fingers moved as she mentally moved the beads of an abacus, shuttling them left and right. If the pyramid was solid heads, there were somewhere in the neighborhood of 1,000 heads here. Cold tingles shot over her skin, the precursor to vomiting. She looked away. You're a spy, Caris. You have to find out everything important. Taking long, deep breaths, she examined the bottom corner of the pyramid, then looked edge-on at one face of the shape. It was made of multiple layers of different colors of Luxin. King Haradul wanted this to last for years. Someone could attack the pyramid with a sledgehammer, and they might be able to crack it, but not break it open. There would be no burying these heads, or removing this hideous monument. The skill evident here meant King Haradul had access to a number, perhaps a large number, of fairly talented and skilled drafters. Bad news. Caris had heard Gavin express his belief that King Haradul was starting a pseudo-Chromeria to train his own drafters away from the Chromeria's oversight. This was pretty strong evidence that Gavin was right. Bastard, Caris said. She wasn't sure whether she meant Haradul or Gavin. How stupid was that? She was staring at a pile of heads, and she was as angry at Gavin as she was at the monster who'd done this. Because he'd slept with some strumpet during the war? Insanely, even after the great fire that had ruined everything in her life and killed her brothers, Caris had been more than half tempted to go over to Dazen's side during that time, if only to hear his side of what had happened. Maybe Gavin had known. Or maybe it was the guilt of his illicit liaison that had caused Gavin to break their betrothal right after the war. So he was unfaithful. Welcome to the common fate of women who love great men. For all you know, it was only one night of weakness on the eve of the last battle, some beauty throwing herself at him, and he didn't say no. Just once. Right. But for all I know, every night was a night of weakness. It was years ago, Caris. Years. How has Gavin acted in all the years since the war? Aside from breaking our betrothal and leaving me with nothing? How has he acted toward you in the last 15 years? Decently. Damn him. Aside from lying and secrets. What had he said? I don't expect you to understand or even believe me, but what's in that note, I swear it isn't true. Something about that niggled at her. Why would he compound the lie? The wind shifted and blew smoke across the open square. Caris coughed, her eyes burning.
but just as she finished coughing, she thought she heard a crack. Another crack. And then, just a block away, a chimney came crashing down into the torched remains of a house. The dawn was red, a trick of the smoke and spectrums, not a heavenly mirror to all the blood spilled here. Caris began searching the town, looking for survivors and surveying the damage. Do what's right. Do what's in front of you. The town hadn't burned easily. The buildings were stone, albeit with wooden supports, and the trees were green either from manual watering, the river ran right through town, or from their roots reaching deep enough. But every single building in the town centre had burned down completely. That meant red drafters. They must have walked through all the buildings, spraying red lux in on every wooden beam. Caris searched for 2 hours, climbing over rubble in the streets, sometimes having to go around whole blocks. She wrapped a wet cloth around her face but still got light-headed, coughing frequently. She found nothing other than more corpses and a few mournful dogs. All the livestock had been taken. The town church had been the site of a small battle. Alexiot's body lay decapitated like the rest, outside the doors of the church. Caris could imagine him denouncing the soldiers outside, trying to protect those of his flock who'd sought sanctuary within the walls. Inside, she found pruning shears, an axe, and knives, and a pair of cleavers, and one broken sword, and decapitated bodies, and dried, burned blood everywhere. The beams here were seared but hadn't caught fire, either clumsy drafting or religious fear, or the fact that the ironwood beams imported from the deserts of southern Attash were so old and dense. The pews, however, and the bodies had burned. Caris was in a daze, whether from inhaling smoke or just becoming inured to the tableau of death and suffering. In the back corner of the church, behind the stairs, she found a young family, the father with his arms wrapped around the mother, who was sheltering a child. The soldiers hadn't found these. They died in each other's arms from the smoke. Caris checked each of them carefully, feeling for the faint tremor of life at each neck. Father, dead. The mother, a girl not yet out of her teens, dead. Caris took the swaddled babe in her arms last, a boy. She prayed under her breath. But Orholm turned a deaf ear. There was no life in his tiny breast. Caris staggered. She had to get out of here. She put the dead babe down on the nearest table, only to see it was the altar. She careened up the main aisle of the church, past smouldering pews on her left and right, images of another time, another sacrificed babe, joining the horrors before her eyes. She was almost out when the floor collapsed. Chapter 25
"You need to make some choices, Kip," Gavin said. From all he could tell, Kip had only been unconscious for seconds or minutes. It was still dark, the stars burning coldly overhead, the fire not yet scorching his clothes despite its nearness to where he'd fallen. The strangling red Luxin mask was gone, though there remained a light coating of dust, gritty and sharp on his skin.
"I'll kill you," Kip said.
He couldn't trust anyone. Everyone was a liar. Everyone was just out for himself. Fear rose, and that made the anger flare as it sometimes did, hot and fierce and uncontrollable. He sat up, eyes locked on the prism's face. The man looked at him coolly, unapologetic, merely curious about what Kip would do, ignoring his words. Kip wondered if he could conjure giant green spikes from the fire to impale the man. "Smart, Kip. In the middle of Orholo only knows where, you'd kill your guide? For what? For not tolerating your peevishness?" "Not betrayal, Kip. A lesson." Kip shivered. He'd really thought Gavin was going to kill him. And that was the point. He had given Gavin no choice but to show that he couldn't be handled, not by a child. He was not only older than Kip, he was smarter and harder and more experienced. And he demanded respect. And that was appropriate. But that didn't stop Kip's shivering. If only for a few seconds, he'd really thought he was dying, and there had been nothing he could do about it. But this was the one man who could show him how to never be powerless again. This was the man who could teach him how to avenge his mother and Rectan. And Kip was going to sit in silence and stubbornness?
With as much dignity as he could muster, Kip retook his seat on the log. His knees trembled, but he was able to sit without disgracing himself further.
"Sorry," he mumbled, looking away.
He cleared his throat so he wouldn't squeak.
"What choices?"
he asked. He could tell Gavin was a little surprised and pleased that Kip didn't fight, but the man left it alone. "You're my natural son, Kip. That has consequences. For you." Kip was watching Gavin's face closely. He said the words, "my natural son," without a grimace, without even his eyes tightening. Kip wondered if he'd rehearsed to be able to say that so blithely. Kip had seen something of what claiming his own patrimony had cost Gavin, and still the man claimed him without so much as a grimace at Kip's grimace-worthy existence. It had to be an act. Who could be pleased about learning that he'd fathered a bastard? But it was an act for Kip's sake. Gavin was a better man than Kip would have expected. "Being known as my bastard has costs," Gavin continued. "You haven't been raised in privilege, but people who resent those raised in privilege will resent you. You haven't been educated, but those who have been will look down on you if you know less than they do. If I acknowledge you, you'll attract the wrong sort of friends. Those who hate and resent me can't often take it out on me, Kip. I'm too powerful, too dangerous, but they will take it out on you. It isn't fair, but that's how it is. You'll be under constant scrutiny, and both your successes and failures will have repercussions you can't even guess at now. My father may choose not to recognize you. Others will seek to prove you're a fraud. Others will attempt to use you against me, and still others will want to befriend you only in the hope that it will help them gain some favor with me. False friendship is a poison I'd like to protect you from." Too late for that. Kip thought of Ram. Ram, who was always in charge, who always liked smearing Kip's face in his own inferiority and claiming it was friendly teasing. Ram, whom Issa had loved. Ram, dead, lying with an arrow in his back.
"So what are my options?" Kip asked. "I am what I am."
Gavin rubbed the bridge of his nose. "You could go as just another student for the time being. Then, whenever you like, I'll publicly acknowledge you. You'll have time to gain your bearings, to learn who your real friends are."
"By lying to them?"
"Sometimes lies are most necessary with our friends," Gavin snapped. He paused. "Look, I just wanted to give you the option."
"No, I'm sorry. I'm not mad at you. My mother, do you remember what she was like? I mean, before me?"
Kip asked. Gavin's mouth worked. He wet his lips, then shook his head. "I don't remember her, Kip. At all." "So, not exactly a love affair." Kip's emptiness doubled. "There was no family to belong to."
"You're the prism. I guess a lot of women want to be with you," Kip said.
"It was war, Kip. When you expect to die, you don't think about the effects your actions might have on others 10 years on. When you've seen friends die all around you, there's something about making love that makes you feel alive. There was far too much wine and spirits, and no one who would rein in a young hothead who had the misfortune to be the prism. But it's not an excuse. I'm sorry, Kip. I'm sorry for what my thoughtlessness has cost you." "So my mother had one night with you, and she pinned her hopes on that." Kip had no doubt she'd elbowed and schemed her way past a dozen other women who would have gladly shared the prism's bed, and she'd filled years with bitterness for that. Kip forced a laugh, his heart breaking. For all the times he'd dreamed about who his father might be, he'd never dared to dream that he might be the prism himself. But in his dreams, his father had been called away by some emergency. He'd left them because he had to, but he'd loved Kip's mother and Kip, missed them, wanted to come back, and would any day. Gavin was a good man, but he didn't care about Lena. Or Kip. He would take care of Kip because he was dutiful, a good person. But there was no love, no family to belong to. Kip was alone, outside, staring through barred windows at what he would never have. It was like being given a gift that was wildly exotic when you wanted something perfectly common. Still, what kind of an ingrate was he? Complaining? Feeling sorry for himself? Because the prism was his father?
I'm sorry, Kip said. He stared at his fingernails, still torn from his Luxin use. This isn't right. My mother had some problems. I guess she wanted to trap you by showing up with me.
Kip couldn't maintain eye contact. He was so ashamed.
How could you be so stupid, Mother? So mean? You don't deserve this. You saved my life and I've been awful.
Kip blinked, but he couldn't fully stop the tears.
You can leave me wherever. Well, preferably not on a deserted island.
Gavin smirked, then got serious. Kip, your mother and I did what we did. I appreciate you trying to shield me from the consequences of my actions, but you are not trapping me into anything. People can talk, I don't care. Understand? He expelled a breath. Regardless, the only damage I care about has already been done. For a second, Kip didn't understand. The damage was already done. No one even knew Kip was alive. Except Carius. That was what Gavin meant. Kip had caused a rift with the only person in the world Gavin cared about. What had been intended to make Kip feel better hit him instead where he was weakest. His mother had made him feel guilty for simply existing for as long as he could remember. He'd ruined her life by being born. He'd ruined her life by having too many demands. He'd made people look down on her. He'd held her back from all the things she could have done. Mentally, he could try to shrug off her words. She didn't mean it. She loved Kip, even if she had never said the words. She didn't know how she was hurting him. But Gavin was a good man. He didn't deserve this. Kip. Kip. Gavin waited until Kip looked up at him. I will not abandon you. Visions of a locked cupboard, screaming. Screaming, and no one answering.
Is there anything to eat? Kip asked, blinking. I feel like I haven't eaten in a week.
He poked his chest. He could feel ribs sticking out. Gavin pulled a rope of sausages out of his pack, cut one off. Only one? And tossed it to Kip. Tomorrow you start at the Chromeria.
Mom?
Kip asked, mouth full. I'm going to share a secret with you, Gavin said. I can travel faster than anyone suspects.
You can disappear and reappear somewhere else. I knew it, Kip said.
No. But I can make a boat that goes really fast.
Oh, that's amazing. A boat.
Gavin looked nonplussed. Point is, I don't want anyone to know how fast I am. There's a war coming, and if I need to unveil it, I need it to be a surprise. You understand?
Of course, Kip said.
Then I need you to tell me what you want. I'm going to go take care of some things while you're being initiated.
Initiated?
Just some tests to determine the rest of your life. You're late, though. All the other students have already started, so we have to hustle you in. After initiation, you can stay and be trained. Kip's throat tightened. Dropped alone on a strange island, knowing no one, and having little time to prepare for a test that was supposed to determine the rest of his life. On the other hand, the Chromeria was where he'd learn the magic he needed to kill King Charadul.
What's the other option?
You come with me. It was light at the end of a tunnel. Kip's heart flipped.
And what are you going to do?
What I'm good at, Kip. Gavin stared up, his irises swirling rainbows. He smiled, but it didn't touch his eyes. When he spoke, his voice was cold and distant as the moon. I'm going to make war. Kip swallowed. Sometimes, looking at Gavin, he felt like he was staring through trees, getting glimpses of a giant striding through a forest, crushing everything in his path. Gavin turned his eyes back to Kip. His face softened. Which mostly involves boring meetings to convince cowards to spend money on things other than parties and pretty clothes. He grinned. I'm afraid you've probably seen more magic out of me already than most of my soldiers ever did. His eyes clouded. Well, not quite. You look confused.
It's not really about what you just said, but...
Kip stopped. It seemed like a pretty offensive question, now that it was halfway out of his mouth.
What do you do?
As prism?
Yes, sir. I mean, I know you're the Emperor, but it doesn't seem like...
Like anyone listens to me? Gavin laughed. Seems like it to me, too.
The bald truth of it is that prisms come and go, usually every 7 years. Prisms have all the foibles of lesser men, and huge shifts of power every 7 years can be devastating. If one prism sets up his family members to govern every satrapy, and the next prism tries to set up his own in their places, things get bloody fast. The colours, on the other hand, the 7 members of the spectrum, are often around for decades, and they're usually pretty smart, so prisms have been managed more and more over time, given religious duties to fill their days. The spectrum and the satraps rule together. Each satrapy has 1 colour on the spectrum, and each colour is supposed to obey the orders of his or her satrap. In practice, the colours often become co-satraps in all but name. The jockeying between colour and satrap, and all the colours and the white, and all the colours and the white against the prism, pretty much keeps order. Each satrapy can do what it wants at home as long as it doesn't rile up any other satrapy and trade keeps flowing, so everyone has an interest in keeping everyone else in check. It's not quite that simple, of course, but that's the gist. It sounded plenty complicated enough.
But during the war?
I was appointed Promarchos. Absolute rule during wartime. Makes everyone nervous, in case the Promarchos decides that the war lasts forever.
But you gave it up.
It was a dumb question, Kip realized. But Gavin smiled. And wonder if wonders I haven't been assassinated. The Blackguard doesn't only protect prisms, Kip. They protect the world from us.
Or Holland.
Gavin's world sounded more dangerous than what Kip had just left.
So you'll teach me to draft?
He asked. It was the best of all worlds. He would learn what he needed to learn without being set on a strange island alone. And who could teach drafting better than the prism himself? Of course. But first, there's some things we have to do. Kip looked longingly at the sausage rope Gavin still held.
Like, eat more?
Chapter 26. By noon the next day, Kip had fully swallowed his teasing about a fast boat. They were flying across the waves at mind-boggling speed, and Gavin had enclosed the boat, muttering something about that woman and her ideas. So now, despite the speed, they could speak. "So you've used green," Gavin said, as if it were normal for him to be leaning hard forward, skin entirely red, feet strapped in, hands gripping 2 translucent blue posts, throwing great plugs of red Luxin down into the water, sweating profusely, muscles knotted. "That's a good colour. Everyone needs green drafters."
"I think I can see heat, too. And Master Danavis said I'm a superchromat."
"What?"
"Master Danavis was the dyer in town. Sometimes I'd help him. He had trouble matching the reds as well as the Alcaldessa's husband liked."
"Corvin Danavis?" "Corvin Danavis lived in Recton?"
Yes.
"Slender, about 40. Beaded mustache, couple freckles, and some red in his hair?"
"No mustache," Kip said, "but otherwise."
Gavin swore quietly.
"You know our dyer?" Kip asked, incredulous.
"You could say that. He fought against me in the war. I'm more curious about you seeing heat. Tell me what you do."
"Master Danavis taught me to look at the edges of my vision. Sometimes when I do, people glow, especially their bare skin, armpits and, you know."
"Groin?"
"Right."
Kip cleared his throat.
"Blind me," Gavin said.
He chuckled.
"Well, what's that mean?"
"We'll see later."
"Later? Like what, a year or two? Why do all adults talk to me like I'm stupid?"
"Fair enough. Unless you're truly freakish, you're likely a discontiguous bichrome." Kip blinked.
"A what? "I said I'm not stupid. Ignorance different."
"And I meant later today," Gavin said.
"Oh.
There are 2 special cases in drafting. Well, there are lots of special cases. Or Holland's great bloody..." "I've never tried to teach the early stuff. Have you ever wondered if you were the only real person in the world and everything and everyone else was just your imagination?" Kip blushed. Back home, he'd even try to stop imagining Ram, hoping the boy would simply cease to exist.
"I guess so."
"Right. It's one of a puerile mind's first flirtations with egoism. No offense."
"None taken."
"Since I have no idea what you just said. It's attractive because it validates your own importance, allows you to do whatever the hell you want, and it can't be disproven. Teaching drafting runs into the same problem. I'm going to assume here that you do accept that other people exist.
Sure, I'm not much for lecturing myself, Kip said.
He grinned. Gavin squinted at the horizon. He'd rigged up two lenses, separated by an arm's length, and mounted on the Luxin canopy so he could scan the seas. He must have seen something, because he banked the skimmer hard left. Port. Hard to port. When he turned back, he'd apparently missed Kip's quip. Anyway, where were we? Ah. The problem with teaching drafting is that color exists. It's separate from us, but we only know it through our experience of it. We don't know why, but some men, subchromats, can't differentiate between red and green. Other subchromats can't differentiate between blue and yellow. Obviously, when you tell a man that he can't see a color he's never seen, he might not believe you. Everyone else who tells him red and green are different colors could be just playing a cruel joke on him. Or he must accept the existence of something he'll never see. There are theological implications, but I'll spare you. To make it simple, if there are color-deficient men, incidentally, it is almost always men, why could there not also be those who are extremely color-sensitive, superchromats? And it turns out there are, but they're almost always women. In fact, about half of women can differentiate between colors at an extreme level. For men, it's one in tens of thousands. Wait, so men lose both ways? Blind to colors more often and really good at seeing them less often? That's not fair. But we can lift heavy things, Kip grumbled. And pee standing up, right? Very useful around poison ivy. I was on a mission with Caris this one time. Gavin whistled.
She didn't, Kip said, horrified.
You thought she was mad at me back on the river? Somehow it was my fault that time, too. Gavin grinned. Anyway, to end my way back to my point, most of us can see the normal range of colors. Tautology there.
What?
Kip asked. That's a digression too far. Just because you can see a color doesn't mean you can draft it. But if you can't see a color, you'll draft it poorly. So men aren't as accurate when drafting certain colors as superchromat women, which is half of them. Will can cover a lot of mistakes, but it's better if there aren't mistakes to begin with. This becomes vital if you're trying to build a Luxin building that won't fall down.
They make Luxin buildings?
Gavin ignored him. The special cases that I started all this to tell you about are sub-red and super-violet. If you can see heat, Kip, there's a good chance you can draft it.
You mean I can start a fire, like whoosh?
Kip made a grand, sweeping gesture. Only if you say whoosh when you do it, Gavin laughed. Kip blushed again, but Gavin's laughter wasn't mocking. It didn't make him feel stupid, just silly. There was plenty scary about the man, like Master Danavis was scary sometimes, but neither seemed mean, neither seemed bad. And that would be very strange, Gavin said, because you've drafted green. He looked like he was trying to figure out how to teach something. Have you ever seen a rainbow?
A rain what? Kip asked,
doe-eyed. It was a rhetorical question, smarty. The order of colors is superviolet, blue, green, yellow, orange, red, subred. Usually a bichrome simply spans a broader arc. So they draft superviolet and blue, or blue and green, or green and yellow. A polychrome, much rarer, might draft green, yellow, and orange. A drafter who drafts colors that don't border each other is rare. Caris is one. She drafts green, but not yellow, not orange. And then she drafts most of red and into subred.
So she's a polychrome.
Close. Caris can't quite draft sustainable subred, what they call a fire crystal. Fire crystals don't last long regardless because they react to air, but never mind that. Point is, she's just short of being a polychrome, and that matters.
I'll bet that made her happy, Kip said.
On the bright side, they wouldn't have let her become a blackguard if she was a polychrome. Polychromes are too valuable, and the pressure on her to bear children would have increased. Regardless, it's rare, and it's called being a discontiguous bichrome. Discontiguous because the arcs aren't touching. Bichrome because there are two. See? Everything in drafting is logical. Except what isn't. Like so. Seeing subred is seeing heat, so seeing superviolet should be seeing cold, right?
Right.
But it isn't.
Oh, Kip said.
Well, that makes sense, I guess.
Except that it doesn't.
I have the strongest urge to ruffle your hair, Gavin said.
Kip grunted.
So how is this going to work?
There's a small island we use as an artillery station. There's a tunnel between there and the Cromeria, which is a secret so important that if you tell anyone, the Cromeria will hunt you down and execute you.
He said it cheerfully, but Kip had no doubt that he was serious.
Then why did you just tell me? Kip asked.
I could let it slip.
Because I've already shared a secret that I think is more important. The existence of this skimmer. But if you betray that secret to our enemies, the Cromeria might do nothing. But if you do betray us deliberately, you'd also tell them about the escape tunnel. So now if you betray me, you'll betray the whole Cromeria too, and they'll come after you and they'll kill you.
Kip felt a chill. This man was warm, personable. Kip had no doubt that Gavin liked him, but in Gavin's circles, you could like someone and still have to kill him.
The casual way that Gavin prepared for Kip's possible betrayal told Kip he'd been betrayed before and been caught unaware by it. And Gavin wasn't the kind of man who had to learn a hard lesson twice.
I'm going to dock on the island and put you on a boat to the main island. I'll send a blackguard with you to take you to the